Hello, everyone. Welcome to another binary episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z, who I'll let get into the Spot the Vuln solution here, which I believe is perhaps the first Spot the Vuln we've had in a while, at least, that nobody seemed to solve. And there's some interesting nuances there, so I'll let Z get into that.
Yeah, this one is, I think, kind of an interesting bug, at least in my mind. That said, I might have also messed up, and this may or may not actually be exploitable. So let me get into it. We've got a relatively simple web application here, register endpoint, verify email endpoint. So you have register, takes in a variety of fields from the user, stores them into this little user object, and just kind of stores it away somewhere. I stub that out, just insert pending user. It has all the fields you provided, stores it somewhere, and sends an email to the new user. That's supposed to be like your email verification. So you provide an email, sends in an email with code, you return. The second route that's defined here is verify email, and you give it the token. When you give it the token, it goes, looks up, hey, what user had this token, pulls that user back. So presumably that's that same information you provide during registration. That's all attacker controlled. From there, the only thing this application does is it parses the email address, splits on the N or on the at sign, grabs kind of the domain from the email, everything after the at, and returns that as the organization. As long as it parses something, it adds the user to this organization. My thought on the vulnerability here was actually something that we have covered before. It returns that when it's getting the organization, it also uppercases the email. So if you provide in lowercase, it would just convert everything to uppercase and uses that as the organization, kind of as a form of normalization. So we did cover a kind of similar issue to this before, where there was an overlap in actually parsing. I don't know if they use the term organization, but that idea where a user belonged to one group and was put into the wrong group, which is kind of what you're going for with this one. It's a bit more of a logical attack where, you know, is there some way where you can get a user added to the wrong organization despite having validated their email? And my thinking with this challenge was that with this uppercase, if you provide Unicode characters, there are some Unicode characters that will, when you convert them between cases, so going either from lower to upper, or if it's an uppercase character going to lower, will end up changing their representation, maybe going from one character to a couple of different ASCII characters, for example. I have a few examples of this that I could bring up, and I can't name what these characters are, but like you've got this kind of B-looking character that when you uppercase it becomes SS, or one here that turns into S, FF. There's a few different cases for this. There used to be a tool that would list out the case folding conversions that could be used to kind of reference what characters you could use for what. I'm going to include the link here in our show notes. Actually, it's not showing up in chat, so I'll have to do that manually, but it's not loading for me. I'm not sure if this is just dead and it's never going to work again, or if it's just down today. It's been a while since I've used it. I had the link saved. So I'll have that in the show notes, at least. It was just like the Unicode utility that would actually give you the complete list. I don't have the link. I was going to see if I had the link for the spec instead. You have these kind of case conversion issues that happen. So jumping back to the actual vulnerability here, if you provided a kind of crafted domain that had one of these characters in it, in theory, you have the email sent down. When you send the email, it should get converted to like the Puny code representation of whatever that host is. So the fact there are these weird characters shouldn't really matter. It gets converted to Puny code, and you can have it go to like your whatever email. But because it's using the original user input when it comes to actually parse it for the host rather than the email as, or rather than the email as like the email was sent to, the domain as it was sent to. You kind of have a desync there where it sends an email to one address, which is this punny code version of the email. But the one that it's parsing here includes the Unicode characters. And so when it does this uppercase conversion, you have the potential for any of these characters I was showing earlier, if they're in that string, to be converted out to these characters. And thus you might be able to overlap with another existing organization. Inside, like, you know, since the S character is one of these, like, there was a Microsoft organization, Microsoft.com, only, you know, accessible by people with a Microsoft email, you'd be able to create the domain that used this kind of R-looking-ish character. I don't know what you'd call that little hook. You would use that character, register the punny code domain, so you get the email for it. Get it back, and when it converts to uppercase, it would become Microsoft.com instead of this random character in there. So that was kind of the vulnerability I was going for. Now, where I'm unsure about now, when I tested this, I didn't send it through any of the email. I just made sure, like, okay, yeah, this punny code conversion happens how I expect, and I used Cyber Chef for that. Seems like I'm not sure if Cyber Chef is the one in the wrong here or some of the other ones, but I just happened to use a different punny code thing or converter as a test case earlier today, and it did not convert it in the same way. It actually basically wouldn't, or it would lowercase first and then convert. And in that case, using the uppercase here kind of doesn't work so well when it does the transformation to lowercase first. So there's a chance that this code may not have actually been exploitable how I expected, just because I had used the Cyber Chef. It operated one way. Seems like there might be some difference there that I wasn't aware of. That kind of breaks the exploitability on this one. But the core issue with Unicode and with this case conversion is something to kind of keep in mind. This case may not have been exploitable. We have talked about at least one vuln in the past that took advantage of this issue. So, like, it is out there, but maybe not with the actual domain registrations exactly as I had it here.
I was about to say, yeah, the fundamental concept we've seen before, so it's valid, but how exploitable it is going to depend on the situation, you know, what's being done internally, I guess.
So, yeah, I kind of stubbed out the whole, send email is just a random function there and don't include how it works. So you could assume it works how I'm expecting it to, and like in this way that allows for the vulnerability. I hate doing that with the spot the vulns where you assume something's doing something vulnerable. In some cases I'm fine with that, where it's a reasonable assumption, it just happens to interact in this vulnerable way. But I don't feel as good about this one, at least until I look into it a little bit more and understand the exact nuances of why there's that difference between what Cyber Chef was doing and what this other tool I was using was doing.
There's a little bit of ambiguity, yeah.
Yeah, no. I definitely, you know, would hate to realize that I put up something that was just completely unexploitable. Sorry if you kind of thought about that and were like, oh no, it would do this other thing and it would be fine. But yeah, if you didn't think about it, you know, this is a bug class, so at least think about it. It doesn't come up too often, I'll be honest. I've only seen it once in the, like, personally on an assessment, and it wasn't in an exploitable way. Like, it wasn't doing anything security sensitive. So I've never actually exploited this one in the wild, but it is an interesting bug class to look for.
All right, so unfortunately today we don't have too many topics. We struggled finding some interesting ones, but we do have a few things to talk about. Including a Windows DHCP v6 RCE, a paper on side channeling the Linux kernel heap, and a discussion on Rust coming into the Windows kernel. We'll start off, though, with the ZDI post on an RCE in the Windows DHCP v6 service, which is actually the only vulnerability that we have this week for the binary side of things. Z, do you want to get into this one, or do you want me to go into it?
No, I can cover this one.
All right.
Yeah, this, it's not that interesting, honestly. Like Spectre said, we had some issues trying to come up with things for this episode. That said, it's still kind of fun. So it is a heap-based buffer overflow in the DHCP v6 server. And the key thing is when it's dealing with nested messages, specifically you've got these relay forward messages, it'll create, or just in dealing with the messages, actually, it creates this 1,664-byte buffer, which is 32, it's an array of 32 52-byte structures. So you add all that up, you get the 1,664 bytes. But effectively, it's just, they have a fixed number of structures in there, and you know all the structures are the same size. They do some appropriate checking to make sure that, oh, we're not adding like too many messages to this structure, and they keep track of the current index. They iterate through all the messages being parsed. But if you use nested messages, so if you send a single relay forward message that then has inside of it more than 32 nested messages, in the nesting, it doesn't actually do the bounce checking. So while it does the bounce checking outside of that, it doesn't do bounce checking inside of the nested, or in the code that handles the nesting, so you're able to provide more than 32. We're just going to keep incrementing the index and go out of bounds into your out of bounds right there, potentially leading to code execution. So fairly straightforward, but also kind of fun to have the bug sit in basically deal with that edge case of having the nested message. Not necessarily an edge case, is relatively common, but having it kind of sit in there, and that's where the bounce check was missing.
Yeah, I thought it was a bit interesting how it happens through like the nested relay forward messages, but yeah, it basically comes down to, you know, just allowing too many nested messages and going out of bounds on the buffer. It's somewhat you know, your bog standard overflow, especially in the networking space. Yeah, these kinds of issues crop up a lot.
The overflow is definitely bog standard. The nested aspect's a little bit unique to it. Not special. Like, this isn't anything that's too complicated to understand. It's just, you know, they do the bounce check where it's obvious and not where it's less obvious, basically.
Yeah. All right, so getting into a paper, we have a paper coming out of Seoul National University and UNIST on doing side channel attacks on the Linux kernel heap to improve reliability of heap-based kernel exploits. So I will say, the idea sounds kind of interesting at first blush, and I was kind of buying into it a little bit. That said, I also, like, while Z was covering this about the vault, and I was actually talking a bit on Discord with somebody who pointed something out that, you know, I'll get into in a little bit. First, I'll cover what it's about, though. So the technique they talk about here is called P-Spray, and how it works is fairly simplistic once you boil it down. They basically take advantage of the time it takes to allocate a buffer to try to determine whether or not it was allocated in a fresh slab or an existing one. And the methodology behind that is, often when you're exploiting a heap overflow, well, pretty much all the time when you're exploiting a heap overflow, you want to set up some target object adjacent to your overflow point to be able to hit it and derive whatever primitives you're aiming for. Of course, if you miss that setup, you could just not trigger what you want, or you could end up crashing the system or something due to overwriting important data that you weren't expecting. And one of the ways you avoid this is with doing some heap shaping, right? You try to get your object next to the target allocation that you have, try to improve the chances of getting the object you want for corruption. And what they're aiming for here is determine when an allocation is made in a fresh slab and only try to trigger corruption in those cases. So basically, you're trying to avoid that case where you miss getting a target object set up adjacent to it so that you don't trigger a crash or something that can be detectable to improve your reliability. So it kind of makes sense when you're talking about it at face value. What they use for demonstrating that technique is the message send syscall, which is a pretty popular heap exploit syscall in Linux. It basically allows you to get like an arbitrary sized allocation into the heap, and it has some useful pointers and stuff in the header. And they basically time the amount of time it takes for the message send. If it takes a bit longer than you know, you would expect, they figure it probably has to be allocating in a new slab for it. So simple idea it seems effective given the metrics they have in here. So they tested 10 real-world vulnerabilities, and they found their reliability improved from 56% to 97%. As always, though, I don't really put a ton of stock into these. The 56% figure in particular seems pretty low to me. Generally, shaping the Linux kernel heap, especially in the higher kmalloc caches, unless you're not doing it like sufficiently well, it's not going to be that unstable. Like, I think the main one they target here is the kmalloc 4096 lab, which you should absolutely have higher than 56% reliability if you're doing a sufficient amount of heap spraying.
But yeah, anyway, that number was kind of mysterious to me. Like, they don't have a footnote on it or anything. It's just like, yeah, the average was 56% or whatever, and like no further information.
It's kind of a just trust me, bro statement.
Yeah, and it definitely, you know, raise some warning flags about this paper. They do have an appendix which talks about success rate according to number of dummy objects, which I'm not sure is entirely related to that, but seems like it could be. But they're not using success rate, I think, in the way that we would usually think of it, like the success of the exploit.
You think they're using it in just terms of, like, just not crashing?
Well, in terms of this appendix, it's their success rate with the fixed number of, like, the way they're calculating it isn't in the sense of, like, the exploit landed this many of times, or this many times, like.
Yeah, it's a little, I kind of see what you're saying now, reading into it a bit more. The other thing, though, which I didn't really think of too much at when I first read this paper, but like I said, I was talking to someone on Discord a bit while he was covering the spot the vuln. And the other problem is, for the most part, on modern kernel configurations, you're going to have randomization inside of the slabs. So, like, the order of allocations inside of a slab is not going to be sequential. It's not going to be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Going from lowest address to higher address inside of that slab, it's going to be randomized. So basically, what they're trying for here sounds kind of cool if you don't think about it too much, where it's like, yeah, they try to get an empty slab out, you know, the target object allocated in an empty slab, and then you just overflow into that slab and you're likely to hit it. But the problem is, like, guaranteeing the allocation ends up in an empty slab doesn't really do much for you. Because, yeah, like, it can be anywhere inside of that slab, and you can have other allocations going into that slab too if it's kmalloc marked slab. So, yeah, it's a little bit weird. It sounds like kind of a cool idea, but I don't think in practice it matters very much. I don't think it's going to give you too much. That said, it is fun to see exploring into, you know, going into something different than just spray the heap a bunch of times. You know, it seems to be going for more of like a, what's the word? Like a neat approach, you know, trying to not bombard the heap, but instead be a bit smarter about it. That said, yeah, I did have some problems with some of their metrics in here. I don't think they reflect the real situation of like heap exploitation in Linux very well. I think it's being a bit disingenuous about how, reliable heap, like, underselling basically how reliable heap shaping techniques already are in the Linux landscape, and kind of overselling what this can do, because, like I said, guaranteeing an empty your allocation ending up in an empty slab doesn't really do much for you because of that randomization. So
even with that randomization, you're still going to have that allocation aligned inside of the slab, I believe. Like, even with the randomization, it's not completely random. It is going to be aligned, so the 4096 is still going to be, like, 4096 aligned within that slab. So as you're overflowing, let's assume you've just got a big overflow, you can do the whole thing. You're able to just target all the right offsets, and if you know you're the first one inside, then, like, nothing else should be. I mean, you do have the chance of, like, something racing and ending up in there, too. But if you know you're the only object inside of this slab, you overflow the entire slab, overwriting the exact offsets you want. Now, that does depend on being able to actually do that. That does depend on being able to craft the entire object you want. So that doesn't work when you only want to overwrite, like, up to a certain point. But there is at least a little bit of a benefit to knowing that. Like, there is a use case here. I agree. I don't feel like they gave it a good treatment over like the downfalls of it, whereas they kind of treat it as like this just generically better, and I don't think that's the case. But I do think knowing you're empty, even with the randomization, knowing the slab is empty except for your object does give you some more flexibility with what you're overflowing with and how you're doing that, because you do just have a limited number of places your object might be in. It doesn't have to be the next thing in memory. Just, you know, you have your kind of set offsets that'll end up at, I believe.
Yeah. So overall, like you said, I don't think it's generically applicable to like practical scenarios very much. But there are some cases where it might be useful. And I think the idea is still kind of neat, even though it might not be, you know, inherently useful. Trying to, you know, use timing information to derive the heap state. It is an interesting idea. I will give it that, which is why I thought it would be worth covering here, even though, you know, some of the people I know and, you know, myself included have some, find the applicability kind of questionable.
I'd basically say, like, it's just one of those things you can toss in the toolbox. You might end up in the right scenario for it. It's not something like this is how exploits are going to be written in the future or something. Like, it's not that impactful. I like the idea of using a timing side channel as part of the exploitation, though. It reminds me a bit of, you know, with the Spectre vulnerabilities and stuff. We saw a little bit of kernel exploitation trying to use that, although I do remember one of them was like a multi-day long exploit to leaking out information. So not the most practical thing, but it's fun to see these other sorts of attacks actually finding, even though you're saying not that practical, like finding a bit of a more practical use, at least. A lot of like timing side channels aren't that practical when it comes to like, you know, any sort of web attack. Timing side channels are pretty rough to deal with. So then they require like low level hardware access, which is already kind of game over in a lot of cases. So it's fun to see in this sort of case. And it is something worth some exploration.
Yeah. So getting into our last topic of discussion, we have a discussion around Rust coming into the ecosystem a little bit more. So we've seen it creep into various operating systems the last year or two. Linux is a big one that comes to mind. Google also announced trying to transition into using more memory-safe languages for Android stuff. And it seems now Microsoft is bringing it more into Windows as well. They've announced they're bringing it into the Windows kernel. And we figured we'd use it as a bit of a launching off point to talk about Rust a bit. It's been a while since we've talked about it, and someone in the Discord brought it up as something to talk about. So,
And we've had other requests to talk about too, like YouTube and stuff. So I figured it was worth getting into again. We did talk about this a bit in length on episode 69 when Linux announced that they were adding it into like Linux Next, I think was that discussion when it was just coming up. It's like, we're going to explore and see if this is a good idea or not. So we did talk about once before. That was quite a while back. So it's worth kind of returning to this.
Yeah. So Rust is a little bit of an interesting discussion, especially when you're talking about desktop. And I actually have another tweet that I thought I'd bring up here. Again, it was one of those things where I was talking with some people about it in Discord, where it got brought up. But it was by David Weston, or D-Wizzle, is like his online handle. And he said, for those listening, the tweet was always fascinating to see the outsized attention, exploitation, and memory safety get of all things I announced in my talk. Running Windows without admin is measurably the most positive change and defeats a large chunk of the attack post-exploitation. Attack being ATTNCK. It's like the threat intel sphere for the list of like possible attacks or whatever. Still Rust gets attention.
From MITRE publishes the like attack framework stuff. And really quickly, I will mention, because he talks about of all the things I announced in my talk. So at Blue Hat IL, he gave a talk about Windows security, future of all that, kind of what they're planning and having security by default. So I'm just bringing that up here. There you go. Should have the link in the show notes, but there's also that talk, which is what he's referring to and kind of what spawned Both that tweet, the Register news post that we brought up here also.
Yeah. So with Windows specifically, I believe it was announced that they're going to be starting to transition some of the Windows core libraries into like a Rust rewrite, which, you know, as we've talked about with Rust before, when it comes to memory corruption, using memory safe languages is a fair step to take. Of course, it's not going to mitigate all types of issues, especially in the kernel where you're going to be using unsafe and whatnot. It's not going to kill memory corruption entirely, but it does reduce your attack surface quite a bit, and make auditing easier as well for finding more of the memory corruption style issues.
Yeah, I think auditing is the big thing Rust does. It's not that Rust is more secure. I mean, Rust does have some security guarantees, but the big thing is, like, those security guarantees can and are often going to be, well, not necessarily, they're just often going to be violated, but they're going to step into unsafe code to do things that you just can't safely do. It's just by marking it as unsafe, that's where the attention gets go. Because basically every memory corruption, as far as I'm aware, except for one, which was like pre-Rust 1.0 day, super early, and, you know, core language bug, except for one, has always been introduced either unsafe code broke a violation that safe code later relied on, or kind of... why can't I think of the way to describe? So you basically have either unsafe code introduces it or unsafe. Basically, unsafe code is always involved. I'll just leave it at that rather than trying to explain the whole taxonomy of Rust phones. But unsafe code is always involved, so you can audit the unsafe code and kind of focus in a lot more. It's a lot easier to audit unsafe code than it is to audit the entire code base for unsafe things. Of course, there are also more data-oriented and logic-level attacks that aren't going to be caught by unsafe at all.
Yeah. The other point that's brought forward to the table when Rust is being talked about is the fact that while it will mitigate memory corruptions, of course, it won't mitigate your more logical style issues where it was just like a permission check was missed or something like that. You know, that's not really going to be fixed necessarily, unless it's caught in the rewrite maybe. But I think that's, you know, stretching it a little bit. You know, Rust itself isn't going to prevent those types of issues. And that's kind of what David Weston is hitting on here, is more the fact that, especially in the desktop space, I think memory corruption is a little bit less important than it is in, say, the mobile space, where, you know, iOS and Android and whatnot have kind of moved on and don't really encounter the same types of permission issues that you see as much in like Windows, for example. So you kind of have to resort more towards memory corruption. Whereas with, you know, Ubuntu and Windows, for example, just recently Z mentioned this to me before we started the show, and it's a good point, was that ZDI recently announced with Pwn2Own that they're not going to be accepting, like in their last event, they didn't accept Ubuntu LPEs that functioned offset UID binaries. You had to attack the kernel. And Windows is sort of in the same situation where I don't think memory corruption is often the path of least resistance in desktop. There's just easier targets to go for, like the permission issues, especially where like Windows, you know, was running as admin for so long. It seems that's finally, you know, changing a little bit. But yeah, I think memory corruption is sort of oversold, I guess, or overrepresented in the desktop space. It is the flashier thing to talk about. It's more exciting. There's some cool nuances you can get into, whereas a permission bypass, for the most part, is just like, hey, they didn't check it here. That's it. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
Yeah, you know, but
it's not as flashy to talk about, but it is... it does contribute more to like the security issues in desktop, and that those sorts of issues are where Rust itself isn't really going to help. So I think it is worth keeping that in mind, even though you are seeing, you know, more memory safe languages come in, it's not going to fix everything. There are still various areas where either memory corruption won't be mitigated or memory corruption just isn't that relevant, or as relevant as people like to think.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I at least entirely agree with you on the lack of relevance for memory corruption. Yes, a lot of vulnerabilities exist that are just really high level kind of service, privileged services running, and it's exploitable. That definitely, you know, exists. There's a ton of those really bad services. Like, every antivirus out there is also like your backdoor into having a privileged access. You have that, but that also depends on you, on like, you know, the victim or whatever having that installed, or, you know, on a red team engagement, like whoever, it depends on them actually having that installed. Corporate environment, you could actually make some assumptions on that pretty nicely about them having like an EDR or something. So like, you can maybe depend on that a little bit more, but on the flip side, like a kernel vulnerability, memory corruption in the kernel depends on having the kernel, which everybody has. Like, you don't have that dependency that you have with kind of going the service route. And I don't think you have as much of the same issue with like just the default services that Windows deploys with. Somebody who's more on the Windows realm and who does, like, especially any red teamers out there can probably correct me if I'm wrong about that. But my understanding is, like, a lot of the Windows services aren't just innately broken, but, you know, your third party other things you're going to install maybe would be. But I do, like, a big thing is almost everybody just runs as admin by default, and then there's just like UAC, which I don't know if we want to get into this discussion about like what Microsoft considers a security boundary, but you kind of have that aspect where everybody's running with high privileges and limited or minimal security boundaries already. So he calls out in this tweet, Windows without admin is measurably the most positive change. And like, honestly, it is. Like, that is a huge change if they're pushing for that, pushing to have people actually running a user account. That's going to be massive for just reducing the attack surface. Probably more impactful than a lot than cutting down on memory corruption. But if we want to keep this focused on the impact of Rust and kind of how Rust impacts VR, like, I guess the Spectre ended off with, memory corruption is still going to exist in Rust binary. It's going to be easier to audit for, which is going to limit the, I guess, frequency of vulnerabilities. Like, if you're needing to mark everything as unsafe, you're suddenly a little bit more aware and thinking about what you're doing than you might be when everything is unsafe, when, like, there is no distinction. You kind of just fall into the pattern. It's like, oh, why do I need to make this unsafe? What am I actually doing here? You know, hopefully with that awareness, it'll cut down on at least some of the vulnerabilities. But like, even if everything were written in Rust, there's still room for exploitation there. I think just in general, like, this ties in with my thoughts on the future of like memory corruption is, it'll get more difficult, but also just vulnerabilities are going to push more towards those logical issues. We've talked about seeing memory corruptions introduced with more logical issues in the past, too. Like, just because it's a logical issue doesn't mean you're getting no memory corruption out of it. And Rust doesn't do a lot to prevent those sort of logical things. So I think as we see more Rust, and I think it's a positive change to move towards that, it's just kind of shifting the style of vulnerabilities, and you've just got to kind of keep up with it. And of course, there's going to be plenty of old code out there that is not running in Rust, and that you can still exploit like it's the 90s.
That's kind of how I'd summarize my thoughts, is that it's definitely not a bad step. It is a good step to migrate more code into, you know, the more memory safe languages. But it's not like something that you should hope, like, bank all of your eggs into, I guess, like, into that basket. It's not going to stop the logical style attacks or, you know, memory corruption through unsafe. So it's something to keep in mind. It's not like it's going to kill memory corruption, as sometimes people seem to echo for whatever reason. There is more nuance to it than that. It is a good step. But yeah, like you said, it's just going to shift the exploitation landscape.
And it will likely,
as per usual with mitigations and stuff,
it will likely kill some attacks and like some number of attacks. Like, there will, with a move to Rust, there probably, I don't have like proper stats on, but there will probably be fewer vulnerabilities, in part because of some of the things I've talked about, like the awareness of unsafe as you're writing it. So, like, if everything moved for us, there would probably be fewer, but not none. It doesn't get rid of everything. People still make mistakes. But, I mean, it's another step. It's kind of like a certain mitigations kind of eliminate or make more difficult entire bug classes. But that doesn't mean there's no more exploitation after you have those mitigations. It just means things change and keep up with it.
It's a good way to summarize it. Yeah, I thought it was kind of an interesting discussion that was spawned off both like this tweet and just, you know, Rust coming in more into the operating system space in general. And yeah, like, it is fun to think about the distinction you have between like desktop, where your attack surface is a lot larger, compared to something like mobile, where it's some years ahead in terms of like attack surface mitigation, and things like Rust coming in are a little bit more impactful, I think. Yeah, there's an interesting dichotomy between the different spheres of operating systems. Like mobile and IoT, I think memory corruption is more of a concern for and trying to hit it compared to desktop.
So well, mobile is still like, you know, the 90s for exploitation. Like it's still, you know, overflow the saved return address, have your NOP sled, and, you know, all
you're of sorry, that. You're thinking it's... of IoT, I assume, not mobile.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, IoT is like that. Mobile, it's not. Actually, one of the things with mobile, I'm not even sure if it's necessarily just years ahead, as you said. It's a completely different paradigm. Like, mobile has gone this whole route. Like, you can't just install these very privileged services. You can have some permissions, but they're a far cry from, like, system privileges or root privileges. Like, it's nowhere near just that same level of access. Like, it prevents the users from having that same degree of access from the get-go. And I don't think we're ever going to get there.
In general.
Yeah, like, I don't think we're ever going to get there on, like, desktop, where everybody's used to being able to just install anything. Phones kind of got that fresh start, and we're able to move into that. But I don't see us getting there on desktop too soon.
Yeah, at least not through the mainstream operating systems. Obviously, you know, there are some, you know, Linux-based operating systems that are more focused on that. Do use things like SE Linux and some of the stuff you see in phones, but people generally don't use them because they're a major pain in the ass to use. For, you know, and that's why you're probably not really going to see that sort of layered permission system come into Windows, for example.
This is going to be year of future.
Year of future. Maybe we'll see it by 2030. It's always fun to, you know, when a new year comes around, you're like, oh yeah, Fuchsia is technically a thing, but not really.
I haven't heard much development on Fuchsia, to be honest, lately.
In my brain, I classify it as a dead project, because I think it kind of is.
It might be.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't think it's officially dead, but it's basically dead
for practical purposes. It's beside the point anyhow. Like, more of my thing was, like, on Windows, or Windows versus the mobile. Like, they're very, very different paradigm over what's there. And I do just want to quickly shout out, as we're talking about this, another bit of news recently was that sudo and su were also being rewritten in Rust. So while we had the focus on the Microsoft stuff, you know, Linux obviously has added it into the kernel over the past couple years, and those core binaries, sudo and su, starting to be rewritten as like Rust projects. So getting rid of some of the vulnerabilities there. And in the last couple of years, we have seen a few interesting sudo vulnerabilities. Can't think of any for SU actually, but we've definitely seen for sudo. I won't be surprised to see there were SU ones, but I can't think of any off the top of my head.
I can't really think of many practical memory corruption based exploits that have worked for sudo or SU. In general, like the last few years.
We've had like the Qualys ones. We covered them on the podcast a while back. I think it was maybe around this time last year where we had sudo vulnerabilities. Like the, what was it? Baron Same Edit or something? It had a weird kind of name there.
Okay. Yeah, maybe I'm just not remembering. But typically with sudo and su and those types of binaries, you're seeing more, like, we cover them more on the bounty episodes than the binary ones, because it's more just again, more of those logical type issues.
I don't know
issues.
If we've covered pseudo on the bounty episode. I think we've mostly covered it in the binary. But yeah, this one that I was thinking of, at least for Baron Sim, I guess it was 2021, January of 2021. It was a heap-based in pseudo. I just remember this one because one of the exploit techniques they took was to modify, I believe, like a log folder path or a log file path. And then they did the log rotate.d kind of attack where you get command execution through log rotate. But they did that sort of attack with it, so I thought it was just an interesting approach on like a data-oriented approach in terms of exploiting sudo rather than actually getting like code execution inside of sudo. That's why this one comes to mind, but I know we've covered some other pseudo vulnerabilities also. I can't think of any like super high level logic ones in pseudo specifically though.
I think that's pretty much all the points that we wanted to bring up with Rust in the future of VR. It is something we've touched on a few times before, but you know, like I said, it's been a while, and it is kind of relevant to the discussion again, where it's coming into more places. We figured we'd do a discussion around it. That said, unless you have any last minute thoughts, C, that's all we have for today. So I think we'll probably wrap it up here.
Yeah, I guess my last thoughts are, you know, if you're interested in the memory corruption stuff, even in the wake of Rust, you can kind of keep going. It's still going to be around for a while.
Yeah. All right. So, thanks everyone who tuned in. If you want to catch any past episodes, you can find them on Twitch and all of them on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more off of Anchor. Feel free to join the Discord and follow us on Twitter. Links to those are down below or in the chat. We'll post there whenever we're going live or whenever other content comes out. And we just like to have some discussions in there too. Like I said, our Rust discussion kind of came off the back of the Discord. So yeah, with that said, we'll see you next week.